I'm Judy Swallow, and for Dick Gordon, this is The Connection. Some of the GIs who fought for Iraqi freedom are being told that they can't have theirs, not when they were expecting to get it anyway. Thousands planning for a future after their army days have had to put that college course on hold, tell the boss they'll not be back at their desks anytime soon, tell mom and dad to put that welcome cake home in the freezer. Their contracts have been extended by decree. Like the National Guards and the Reserves, the Army is now under order stop loss. Units just waiting for the word, or rather two words, that mean if you're headed for Iraq or Afghanistan, you could be in for much longer than you planned. The Pentagon says no big deal, or rather, it's part of the deal. The contract with the military is an oath of service to the country, and the country needs them. Critics and miserable families say it's proof that the Pentagon planners were wrong and it's not fair the grunts pay the price. Connection listeners, is stop loss a sensible use of resources in wartime or misuse of the forces to cover political mistakes in election year? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's start with Pam Hess, Pentagon correspondent for UPI, joining us from Washington. Pam, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning. Just tell us what this means.
The stop-loss program is something that the military kind of has in its toolbox to manage its personnel. And basically what it means, it's a stop-loss, stop-move. It says that if you are scheduled to move out of your unit to go to school or because your retirement date has come up, you're not allowed to do that until your unit deploys back to the United States from Afghanistan or from Iraq. And then you have to wait another 90 days before you're allowed to leave.
So give us, for instance, first of all, how many troops is it going to affect, and how much longer could their service be extended?
Presumably, it could extend an individual service member's service a maximum of, say, a year and 3 months, but that presumes that that service member was going to retire out of the military the first month that their unit was deployed. At the moment, it's affecting 4,000 of the some 138,000 U.S. personnel that we have in Iraq. I'm not sure what the numbers are for Afghanistan. They don't know how many it's going to affect in the upcoming deployments because they haven't yet figured out or at least publicly announced which units those are that are going to go. And then at that point, they would drill down and look and try to find which soldiers were scheduled for schooling or for additional training or for a transfer or to retire, and then they'll know the numbers. But currently, it affects about 4,000 soldiers.
Have they actually said to these 4,000, your term is going to be extended, or have they said you're on notice that it might be?
The 4,000 that I've spoken of know that they are going to be extended the additional time that their unit is deployed plus 90 days after they return home. The other folks that may be affected have been notified that they, in fact, may be affected. I think most of the soldiers know if their unit is going to be deploying over during the time that they would retire or transfer out, and so they have a pretty good idea if they're going to be held in the military longer than they might otherwise be.
As you said, this is not the first time that the Pentagon has used it since 9/11. How many have actually been affected in total by it?
I'm really pulling this number out of my hat, but I feel like it's a total of 40,000. That doesn't mean that there are 40,000 extra that are still in the military, but 40,000 that were affected by it. So maybe they were held over for another week, another month, and that 40,000 number might include the 20,000 that have been held over in Iraq. I'm sorry, I just don't have those numbers broken down very well, but I think it's been 40,000 since this, quote, global war on terrorism has begun. Doesn't mean that there are 40,000 extra in now, just that they had their terms of service extended.
Did the Pentagon say why they're doing it?
There is, I think, a popular notion that the reason why is that because they don't have enough personnel. And I think it's true, and most people in the military will tell you, yeah, they are really strapped and stretched, and they don't have enough personnel for all of the requirements that they have now, at least looking out for the next couple of years. But stop loss is less of a factor. It's less of a factor of this stretching of personnel and rather where the military is trying to go. The way that the military currently works, it's incredibly complicated, their personnel system, and you'll have soldiers are in individual time. So when a unit deploys over, that unit is going over, but the faces in it might change out multiple times during the course of a deployment. Where the Pentagon wants it to go is that a unit will stay together for 36 months The first year of that would be training, getting them ready to go. The second year of that would be on deployment, doing whatever it is they do, doing exercises. And then the third year, they would begin to swap out new people. And the reason that they say that they want to do it is so that they have some continuity. The last thing that you want to do, especially in a place like Iraq, is pull a soldier out who's been doing patrols and knows people in Fallujah or knows people in Ramadi, actually those are Marine areas, knows people in Baghdad, pull his familiar face out and everything that he knows about the people that he's dealing with every day, who he's relying on Iraqis for information, pull him out and replace him with somebody who doesn't know those people, who doesn't have that facial recognition with them, and who doesn't have any trust. So from a force management and force effectiveness side, that's why they're doing it. They want to keep units together so that they're more effective.
Pam Haas, Pentagon correspondent for UPI, thanks for that. Let's pick up that the theme with Stan Flora. He's a retired Army colonel, currently a defense consultant with Whitney Bradley and Brown in Virginia. Stan Flora, is this a good idea from the Army's point of view, from what Pam was saying there, that you keep the unit together?
Well, I think Pam's got it exactly right. The reason why the Army wants to do this is to maximize unit effectiveness. And as she said, it's important while you're deployed that the same faces are in the unit when you're getting experience on the ground. But more importantly, it's unit cohesion. It's the commander can count on who he's got. He can count on the experience of his NCOs and their training of the junior enlisted soldiers. And everybody's experience level grows together. And everybody's ability to operate as a unit increases as you go along in a deployment. And, of course, in the pre-deployment, a commander is not worried about losing people to this, that, or the other kind of requirement or tasking.
But, Stan, you know, I mean, great, you keep the unit together, but is it worth keeping the unit together if what you've got is a lot of troops whose morale is really low, who are totally disgruntled because they're expecting to go home to their wives and their girlfriends and their boyfriends and their parents and their job and their college course, and, you know, you've got thousands of really miserable guys, and they might all be holding a unit together, but, hey.
That's a very small percentage that, one, that are affected. Two, my experience is soldiers appreciate being soldiers, and they appreciate being in a unit that's functioning well. And so if this means that they're going to deploy with the guys they've been training with and living with and working with for several years, and he's going to have to be in the Army and in that unit a bit longer, there may be some disappointment and some adjustment he's going to have to make in his personal life. But my experience is that guy will be just as good and just as effective through his deployment. He understands. He signed up for what he was doing.
But, Stan, he signed up for a volunteer Army with a limited period. I mean, what does this say about the Army being a volunteer Army? It looks like the draft, doesn't it?
What it says to me is that we're serious about operations, and we're serious about being an effective Army and a good Army. Soldiers understand that. Soldiers appreciate that. Soldiers appreciate being in units that are good. So the few guys that are, in fact, affected by this will be disappointed. But my experience is they will be just as effective, and you're not going to hear a whole lot of disgruntlement from the very few.
Stan Flora, thanks a lot. Stan is a retired Army colonel, currently a defense consultant with Whitney Bradley and Brown in Virginia. Let me now introduce my two guests this hour. With me in the studio is Dr. Cindy Williams. She's principal research scientist at the MIT Security Studies Program, editor of the recently published Filling the Ranks, Transforming the U.S. Military Personnel System. From our NPR studio in Washington, we're joined by Tom Donnelly. He's resident fellow in defense and national security studies at the American Enterprise Institute in D.C. Welcome to you both. Dr. Williams, you've listened to those two guests explaining what's going on. Put it into context for us. Is this the Army panicking or just a logical step?
I think the first two guests framed the issues in a really good way, and you can see some of the tensions. One thing to think about is that there are two separate pairs of questions and each of the pairs of questions need to be treated as pairs. The first is, what is the Army trying to accomplish through stop loss? That's the first half of a pair. But the other half of that is, how have they decided to accomplish it, right? And so you hear the thing about the unit rotation that both the first guests mentioned. They're trying to accomplish the unit rotation instead of the individual replacements.
Well, presumably what they're trying to accomplish is to get enough troops on the ground when they're stretched.
That's not exactly it. It's what you heard was this question about maintaining the unit cohesion. So if all you needed were boots on the ground, you could send them individually. But they're trying to accomplish something bigger than that. They're trying to accomplish units that move to the field together and that stay together and come home together. I think it's a very good policy. And that brings me to the second set of questions, which is, whose interests matter here? And there are two sets of interests that always are in tension: the interests of the individuals who are serving in the military, the people who put on the uniform every day. But there are also the interests of the Army as an institution. And what you just heard from the first two speakers was the different points of view.
Well, I'd like to quickly bring in Tom Donnelly before the break just to get your view on it, Tom. We'll hold that thought, Dr. Williams. We'll come back to it. Tom Donnelly, your view, just, you know, good unit cohesion, and this is the interest of the Army. What do you think?
Well, both are true. I would say that we ought to regard the stop loss issue really as a symptom, and the disease as being just having a force that's too small, both for the missions that it's on and for the internal reforms that it's trying to undertake. All the advantages of unit cohesion and this sort of cohort system, as the Army used to call it, that they're trying to instill, are at least some ways offset by just the higher personnel costs that naturally accrue with trying to keep a group of people together for an extended period of time.
Isn't this just a logical progression? I mean, this clause, this stop loss, was brought in after the Vietnam War because you were going into a volunteer army from the draft. Isn't this the logical progression of that? This is what you have to do, and you've got an emergency, and you've got an emergency, two of them, in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Well, yeah, except that at some point the emergency becomes more frequent than, you know, what you believe to be the baseline case. We've used this tool, and in fact a lot of other sort of extraordinary personnel tools, essentially every time we have an operation of any substantial size. So at some point, you have to step back and say, is this the right way to run an army? If you intend to actually use this army on a fairly periodic basis, then you need to take planning steps that enable it to have the wherewithal to do what you're asking it to do.
Tom Donnelly, we'll get back to that right after the break. So, Connection listeners, what do you think? Whose interests are more important, the soldiers or the army as a whole? 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. We're talking stop loss this hour. GIs being told by the Pentagon they're not going home anytime soon if they're deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan. We're discussing military strategy, but let's look at the political debate now. It's hit the campaign trail. Here's John Kerry.
The administration's answer has been to put a Band-Aid on the problem. They've effectively issued a stop loss policy as a backdoor draft. They have extended tours of duty, delayed retirements, prevented enlisted personnel from leaving the service. And by employing these expedients, they've increased the forces by 30,000 troops. But this has happened on the backs of the men and women who've already fulfilled their obligation to the armed forces and to our country. and it runs counter to the traditions of an all-volunteer army.
Well, let me introduce now Andrew Exum, who's just back from Iraq, see what he thinks about what John Kerry's saying. Andrew's a former army captain. He served in Afghanistan as well as Iraq, and he's author of a memoir, One Man's Army. Andrew Exum, welcome. Is that what you see it, the way you see it, backdoor draft?
Yeah, I think a lot of the things that Senator Kerry says are correct. I got involved in this issue. Actually, I was writing my book, This Man's Army. It was about my first infantry platoon in Afghanistan. And the reason I got involved is because a lot of these soldiers are getting ready to head off to Iraq for upwards of a year. And I knew that some of these soldiers had been to Afghanistan on multiple tours before, and that wasn't so much the issue. But a lot of these guys were due to leave the Army this summer and start a new life as either a college student or in a new career, and I think that's a right they have in the volunteer military.
You've been talking to the man, Ruby. I mean, obviously, a guy who's serving in the military can't talk to us and give his
right,
name.
Yeah,
You've been talking to them anonymously. I mean, are you getting really personal stories? That this is just terrible.
Yeah, I mean, I am. I mean, these guys. I mean, I'm still friends with them. These were guys that I developed a pretty close working relationship with over the time that we were in combat and also back at Fort Drum, New York. And so I'm still close with these guys. I mean, I don't have any biological brothers, so these guys are about as close as I've got.
Interesting that you should say that. You know, you haven't got any biological brothers. You're really close to these guys. Therefore, isn't the idea of stop loss exactly the sort of thing that a guy like you should be defending? Because it keeps the unit together.
Yeah, and the Army uses it. they have correctly pointed out that one of the advantages of stop loss is that the units that train together will then go to war together. The problem is that, like Senator Kerry said, stop loss runs contrary to the traditions of a volunteer force. So it's it has a plus and a minus. You know, on the one hand, it's good because it does keep those units together. On the other hand, it's bad because if you've got soldiers who should no longer be serving and don't want to be serving any longer, well, that could create morale problems. So it's a challenge as well as a boon.
Andrew, do stay with us. 800-423-8255, connection listeners, is how you join the conversation. And Sergeant Major Tony Rose from Elizabethtown in Kentucky is joining in. Sergeant, the reason I wanted to bring you in was to talk to Andrew because you, I gather, wrote the stop-loss policy.
Yes, ma'am. I recently retired from the Pentagon with 31 years of service. Of that 31 years, 25 years was a senior counselor and proponent for retention program. I left the Pentagon as a senior writer and proponent for the program.
So tell me the idea behind it.
Well, actually, stop loss is not new. If you go all the way back to George Washington, he actually had to pull money out of his pocket to be able to keep soldiers around the fight at Trenton. Stop loss is something that the military has used over its longevity. In fact, as you correctly said, it was really employed after Vietnam, but it was also used during World War I and World War II, as you needed to keep particular soldiers with endemic knowledge or combat experience in a unit. Stop loss does not affect everyone all the time. It affects those people that the military needs to perform a specific mission.
What do you say to Andrew's point, though, that it goes against the idea of a volunteer army?
Well, the captain is absolutely right when he talks about camaraderie, sir, and I commend you for your time and service and taking care of the troops as you have. It sounds like you're really soldier-oriented. The issue, though, ma'am, is the technicality of volunteer service. Yes, we have gone to a Volar volunteer army, but every soldier who comes in signs the contract, and on the contract it states that according to the needs of the nation, needs of the service, they can be extended. So soldiers do not go in blindly into it. Volunteer simply means that we are the one nation on earth that has people who willingly sign up to protect our country. But it does not mean that they absolutely have a drop-dead, let's-get-out date right now. ETS, as they call it, is an estimated time of separation. It's not a definite time.
There you go, Andrew. You know, you signed up for it, and it is there in the small print, and it's an estimated time.
Yeah, the sergeant major is exactly correct, and he is also correct when he says that we have used stop-loss in a limited basis for a very long time, especially with military specialties that we have deemed crucial. For instance, after September 11th, civil affairs specialists, special forces soldiers, and I'm sure the sergeant major could talk about that more in depth. However, I think the reason that we need to have an open debate about this stop-loss policy is because in this case, we've expanded it to include every soldier that's either going to Iraq or coming back, and it was expanded just last week. And really, we need to talk about, you know, is this a temporary measure, or is this a way that we are meeting the needs of Iraq and Afghanistan, and are we saying that really the active duty military can't get the job done? Is this, in other words, is this part of a wider debate we need to have in public about whether we need to, A, expand the military? You know, Senator Kerry's talked about boosting the size of the Army by 40,000 personnel, which a lot of people agree with, but that's something that, you know, is going to obviously take a lot of time. Or is this, you know, are we saying that really the volunteer military, you know, like I said, can't get the job done, and we need to start thinking about, A, either, you know, some sort of limited draft, or B, pulling back from our commitments in Afghanistan or Iraq partially or completely. None of those options are very appetizing.
But a lot of issues to bring up in the debate.
Right.
Andrew, do stay with us, because, as you know, we've got two people here to debate just this. Thanks, by the way, to Sergeant Major Tony Rose for raising those points. Dr. Cindy Williams is with me in the studio, author on the military, Filling the Ranks is the name of her book, and Tom Donnelly of the American Enterprise Institute, defense expert there. Dr. Williams, does the debate need broadening? You were talking earlier about, you know, the Army has to look at what it's trying to accomplish and how it's trying to achieve it. Does it really need to start, as Andrew said there, widening the debate?
I think the debate needs to be widened, and it needs to be engaged vigorously in this country. You know, I agree with the point that Tom and Andrew both made, which is that the Army is too small for what the nation has asked it to do, which is right now to be engaged in a large, dangerous counterinsurgency in a country that the nation doesn't understand very well, that's far away over a long period of years. And the Army isn't large enough to do that. Now one has to ask, should we be engaged in that at all? Should we be getting out as quickly as we possibly can? Should we have engaged in it in the first place? But secondly, given that we are there, given that we're there today, I think the Army doesn't have a lot of options besides stop loss, at least for the immediate term.
Tom Donnelly, how would you broaden this debate? Do you say, yeah, we've got to be looking at not going in for long-term engagements, or are you going to say you've got to increase the size of the Army or reintroduce the draft?
Well, I don't see how we can accomplish what we've established as our strategic goals, both in Iraq and in the region. The president's notion that we were going to transform the political order in the Middle East, which I think is a very wise and correct thing to do. But we have to acknowledge that that's pretty heavy lifting, as Cindy says, over a long period of time. And if that's your strategic goal, you have to fashion the military means in order to accomplish that. I don't think it's necessary. You know, all this draft talk is really just, I think, meant to heighten the emotion around the case, because
draft means Vietnam, and so it gets
it's just not necessary. We don't need that level of force. We need more than we have, but we have to recall that we used to have a volunteer army that was 40% larger active force than it is now. There's no, you know, data to suggest that we couldn't do that again and couldn't sustain it consistent with economic growth and all the rest of that stuff, because, in fact, we did that for 50 years during the Cold War.
Well, I'll get Dr. Williams to respond to that in a moment, but let's hear from Lou. 800-423-8255 is how you get in touch with the Connection listeners. Lou's calling from Buffalo, New York. Lou, I think you want to ask something to, or make a point to Andrew, don't you?
Yes, I guess, first of all, I support the troops 110%. I have a son in the Marines. When you sign up in the military, you make a commitment. You make a commitment to serve your country in peacetime and in wartime. And, yes, I realize that with today's volunteer army, that I'm not sure Kerry is right when he refers to a long tradition. That's a political remark. I realize that to try to make the package look nice, we put addendums to it to make the fellas feel good about coming in. And during peacetime, okay, sure, they fulfill their weekend obligation or their once a month or in the summertime, I guess it's 2 weeks during the summer kind of thing for the reservists. But you know, eventually, yeah, they're allowed to go to school and all that too. But that's the gravy train. But right now, we got to pay attention to detail, and our country is calling us to serve.
Lou, thanks for that point. Let's hear Andrew's response to that. Andrew, former Army captain, author of This Man's Army. Andrew, what do you say? You know, you signed up for it, okay. You may have signed up for it just hoping the Army was going to pay for your college course, but this is what you signed.
Yeah, no, Lou's exactly right there. I mean, if you join the Army not expecting to do anything, you know, if we're at peacetime, we could become at war very quickly. We certainly learned that on September 11th, 2001. So I think our military commitments became very real for those of us that were in service. I for one served in Afghanistan and Iraq and was very happy to do so. I take great pride in my service. But I think you're talking about something very different when you're talking about the active duty military as opposed to say the National Guard or the Reserve. You know, the active duty military, those are the guys that are really going to get hit the hardest. And just as an example, I'll point out to, say, the 3rd Infantry Division, which deployed to Iraq for 12 to 15 months, depending on your brigade, and then has been back for about 10 months right now, but is getting ready to go right back to Iraq for another year. Look, that has a devastating effect on families, and we have to come to the conclusion that this active duty military that we have currently set up is really a peacetime military. It's not one that's set up for these long-standing expeditionary engagements in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so, you know, when you talk about, say, for instance, comparing it to, say, the Vietnam, and this is the only way I'm comparing the situation to Vietnam, is that, you know, in Vietnam we had a much larger military. And so even if you were a professional soldier, you might only do one, maybe two tours in Vietnam over a 10-year period. Now, where we're sending guys, you know, where 2 out of 3 years they're spending it in Iraq, that's a lot different.
Andrew Exum, thanks a lot. Let's put that point to Dr. Cindy Williams. Is this the problem that these conflicts are too long, Dr. Williams? That's where the planning went wrong.
I think the conflicts are too long for the size that they are. And the point that Andrew Exum makes is the crucial one. The Army is designed largely as a peacetime army, not as a wartime army. If you knew that you were going to be rotating units through and that you needed all the units to be a little bit over strength so that you wouldn't have to have stop loss, you could have designed an army that way, even at its current size. And certainly if you added forces, you could add them in a way that made sense. But that's a reflection of something else that's going on in this country right now, which is the nation doesn't quite know whether it's at peace or at war. The military knows full well at this point it's at war. But, you know, the nation hasn't raised taxes. It's still paying for this war on credit. And I think one of the things that especially bothers Captain Exum and others in the military is that they often feel that they're the only ones who are sacrificing to make this war happen.
Tom Donnelly, American Enterprise Institute in Washington. Is the U.S. at war, but in election year, President Bush doesn't want to make it that explicit? Is this the problem?
Well, I would say yes, but there's more to the situation than that. No question that from a soldier's point of view, this is war. And even from the nation's point of view, but it's a peculiar sort of war. It is a, you know, it is not World War IV. It's more like the Cold War in that it's a low level, again, speaking in a macro sense, long-term commitment. It is particularly the kind of combat and soldiering that requires experienced, regular soldiers. You don't want to take conscripts through the streets of Fallujah or out into the hills of Afghanistan. You want well-trained, fit, experienced, cohesive units.
Give us some number crunching. I mean, you as you say, you don't want amateurs. You want professionals. You want
exactly
the guys
so.
Who are going to do the job. How many do you reckon the Pentagon needs to do the jobs it's doing at the moment?
I believe that, and this burden falls really exponentially more greatly on the Army, that the Army needs to be larger by something like 60 to 70,000 soldiers in order to sustain this level of effort, have something, you know, on the shelf in case yet another crisis breaks out, which is, you know, not impossible. And also, we don't want to forget this internal reform trend that's been that Secretary Rumsfeld and the Pentagon more broadly over the last 10 years has been trying to undertake. There's a personnel bill that is associated with that as well. If we're going to establish these highly cohesive units, this is like applying the Marine system across the board. That's not the inexpensive way to do personnel policy.
Dr. Williams, do you agree with those numbers, more or less, about 60,000 to 70,000 more troops, and that would do it for the Pentagon? That would do it for the Army, anyway.
I would actually put the number higher, because the Army has two problems it needs to solve. If it's going to continue at this rate of deployment for, say, another 5 years, I think it needs another 100,000 troops. First of all, because it needs more units to sustain a rotation base to keep doing this, and then because each unit needs to be somewhat overstaffed in order to avoid situations like stop loss.
But you know about Pentagon planning, and you're pretty politically savvy. You're not going to get these funds from Congress, are you?
Well, Congress has been the one pushing for additional troops for the Army, while the administration has been holding back, saying, no, it's too expensive, and partly saying no, I think, for political reasons, in the sense that to add troops at this point is to admit that you're there for the long haul.
Tom Donnelly, in a word, do you agree with that?
I would agree with Cindy 100% on that, and I'd even go for her higher number. I thought 75,000 was the most I could get away with. Look, the roadblock is unquestionably the executive branch and the administration. If the president asked for this, the Congress would give it to him in a heartbeat. This actually, I think, would have been the case,
Tom, we'll
after
leave it
September 11th.
We'll leave it there for the moment. Connection listeners, would you be willing to pay more taxes to get another 50, 60, 70, 100,000 troops in the Army? 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. We're talking stop loss this hour. In other words, stop the loss of soldiers. To that end, the Pentagon's issued orders saying that a lot of GIs going to Afghanistan or Iraq are already there, aren't coming home anytime soon. What do you think? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Cindy's joining us from Norfolk in Virginia. Cindy, what's your point?
Good morning. I have a question. When I listen to those who are saying that the men and women who signed the contract are not being told that they may stay, what is, first of all, what's the point of having that contract? And number two, what effect will this have on the future of men and women who want to volunteer? If you're a young man or woman and you're listening to this program and you're saying to yourself, well, it's something I considered, but now that I hear about the stop loss, you know, this is something that if I sign a contract, it's not going to be, you know, it's not going to be adhered to. So.
And the pay isn't that good either. Cindy, thanks for that point. Let me put it to Dr. Cindy Williams, author of Filling the Ranks. Dr. Williams, is that a real danger, that it's going to undermine the whole concept of a volunteer army, because guys aren't going to, and women aren't going to volunteer?
There is a danger that recruiting will suffer because of the stop loss, that people take a look and say, you know, I always knew that the military contract in the fine print said that you could be kept over, but it never happened to anybody. And so the compact that I understood was the person's deal with the nation was that you would serve a certain amount of time and be out. So there is some danger that recruiting will suffer. I'm not sure that that's going to be the real problem. The real problem is more likely going to be in retention. And unfortunately, we don't know, because of stop loss, we don't know how good or how bad retention would be, how many people would stay voluntarily through this period.
Isn't that part of the idea of stop loss as well, though, that you have to stay on for 3 extra months after you go home from being abroad? Isn't it sort of so that the soldiers get time to kind of cool down and think about it, and therefore they might re-enlist for another 5 years.
It's not just so they can cool down and think about it. It's also so that their units can regroup and they can start bringing new members in and not bring them into a unit that's totally disbanded.
Well, let's hear from Tom Donnelly of the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. Tom, you know, you said earlier in the program that what's really needed is critical mass of numbers, and these guys have to be pros. Why not hire them? Why not move more into the private sector, more contractors?
Well, because there's a war going on. I mean, look, we've tried a whole bunch of new, actually pretty innovative approaches to solving the problem of how to project and sustain military power. The X factor is that people are going to be shooting at Americans for a long period of time. So the question is, can this structure sustain, you know, a wartime stance? Not so much, you know, will marginal things like stop loss or dumping a little bit more of the logistics burden on a private contractor serve the need. I think people who have, and Cindy, I'm sure, would agree with this, people who have, you know, kept an eye on personnel policies have been watching this question of recruiting and particularly retention for some time now. But the new factor in all the equation is not so much the pace of deployments or the extra time in service, but the fact that the quality of time in service is now marked by combat. If you're going to be a professional soldier in this era, you're going to be going to war repeatedly.
Let's hear from a professional soldier. 800-423-8255 is the number to call, Connection listeners. Byron is joining us from Durham, North Carolina. Byron, your point. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. And yourself?
I'm doing fantastic. I just retired after 21 years of service time on June 1st.
Well, congratulations. What's your point? What would you like to ask the guests?
Well, your guests have done a really good job at capturing a lot of different aspects. The only thing that I can really add to it after doing it, the past 16 years I spent in Special Forces. I was a Special Forces medic and a Special Forces operations sergeant, and I've been involved in every armed conflict that's happened within the world since 1991.
And have you ever been under a stop-loss order?
Oh, yes, I have. Yes, I have. The past couple of years, the policy that came down originally, I looked at all these because it was very interesting to me, and organizational theory and design was an extremely important thing to me, too. There's a lag time between determining what you need and your policies and everything like that.
Okay, Byron, you understand why the military planners are doing it, but tell us your experience.
Right.
Were you really annoyed at the time, or did you say, fair enough?
No, I was a professional and saw absolutely the need for it, and everyone that I'd worked with, either Special Forces-wide or just a normal private in the Army or the Air Force, they had no problem with it. The problem that's arising now is they're addressing a symptom and not addressing really what's occurring. They need a policy that will recruit people, develop people, and retain people. And the numbers are about right. You need about 100,000 people in the Army alone, because we're only talking about operations over in one area of the world. What happens if we start developing something somewhere else?
Well, let's ask Dr. Cindy Williams there. Cindy, they're addressing the symptom, not the cause.
I agree with that, but I also think once you're backed into this corner, there's only one thing that the Army can do to take care of it right now, and that's stop loss. Over a period of time, they can add people, but the Army already has the authority to add 30,000 people. They're running 10,000 over what they're normally permitted already. They're allowed to add another 20. But first they have to recruit them. Then they have to train them. And so they're only planning to do it 10,000 per year just because they're concerned about outstripping the capability of their training base.
But they are offering other things, aren't they? I mean, it's not just all stick, which is stop loss. There's carrots as well. Aren't they offering huge bonuses, $10,000, $15,000 if you stay on?
They're offering very good bonuses for people to stay on. If you're in Iraq already and your time to reenlist comes up, they're offering at least $5,000 to sign the papers to reenlist. That's quite attractive. In addition, if you're kept in Iraq for more than a year and you don't volunteer to do that, then there's a $1,000 a month bonus. So they are really trying to work with the carrots.
Byron, thanks for your point. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Mike's joining us from Newport, Rhode Island. Hi, Mike.
Good morning, folks. Very good show today. My comment has much to do with why wasn't this taken care of 6, 8, 10 months ago when it became very evident that we were going to need more troops in this area? It's just now that they're talking of shifting troops from Europe and other places that and Korea, which is pretty hot right now. I see this as kind of a, maybe not a stop loss, but a stop gap measure, and as a failure from the folks who orchestrated this entire thing.
Tom Donnelly, what do you say to that? Tom Donnelly at the American Enterprise Institute, you know, failure of planning, sure. You know, from 9/11 onwards, they saw they were going to go to war in Afghanistan and probably pretty surely going straight into Iraq. Bad planning?
Very bad planning. Couldn't agree more. I think anybody, you know, any staff college student would have come up with a similar solution. I think what, just to describe what happened, was that the success, the immediate success in Afghanistan and the correct anticipation that the actual invasion of Iraq would require far fewer forces than traditional planning would have anticipated, you know, sort of misled the administration into thinking that the post-combat situation would be similarly as easy. There's been a lot of talk about that, but I don't think there's any doubt that the time to have made these adjustments was immediately after September 11th.
Dr. Williams.
Well, if you remember, on the eve of the war, Army Chief of Staff, then Army Chief of Staff General Eric Shinseki, said that it would take
400,000.
Hundreds of thousands of troops for this phase of this war. And he was basically poo-pooed by the administration. He was ready to start the planning then. So it's not a failure of Army planning. It's a failure of the administration's understanding.
Political
of how,
planning.
Yes, of how difficult this phase of the operation could be.
But Tom Donnelly, I mean, it has redefined the military ethos, hasn't it, or the whole military thinking in the Pentagon, because they were seeing it as long-distance wars won very quickly with fewer men and high tech. And it actually worked in Kosovo, and to an extent it worked in Afghanistan because they got people on the ground supporting them. Things went wrong in the post-conflict situation in Iraq.
I think that's basically true, but I would remark and lament that if you read the just about to be issued national military strategy, they're still trying to regard, stability operations and post-combat operations as lesser included cases of warfighting. And the emphasis is still very much on rapidity, mobility, agility, and all these buzzwords that we've been living with for the past 10 years. They're still in the mindset that, you know, getting there rapidly is more important than how long we stay. And I think the counterexample of Iraq is pretty compelling, but I'm not sure the lesson's been fully learned yet.
Dr. Williams, if it really is a case of, you know, 30, 40,000 more troops on the ground, we have heard, as Mike pointed out, that 12,500 are being pulled out of South Korea. Some are going to be pulled out of Germany. Can't you just move them around?
I think those troops are going to be needed just to maintain the rotation base. And certainly there are troops to be moved around. One thing that people don't usually talk about is that while the Army is under strength for what it's trying to do, the Air Force is actually over strength for what it needs to do, and so is the Navy. The Air Force and the Navy are both looking to get people off their roles. And there's even some talk about what people are calling blue to green shifting. A person would show up in his or her Air Force uniform one morning and go home in the afternoon in an Army uniform. Some amount of that can be done depending on the people's career fields. Also in the Army, there are so many people who would never deploy to combat. Of the army that's about 500,000 people today, there are about 125,000 who would never deploy. They're in office jobs or they're in maintenance jobs in units that don't go overseas. A lot of that work could be contracted out. And then you wouldn't have to contract out the kind of work that's on the battlefield that really becomes problematic.
Tom Donnelly, in Washington, does President Bush have to come clean with the American public and say, we need more money, more troops, and sorry, it may be election year, but you're going to have to cough up for it?
I think this is unquestionably a job for presidential leadership, whether it be this administration or, just practically speaking, most likely the next administration. I certainly, just my read of the political situation is that if President Bush said, we need this in order to win the war on terrorism and succeed in Iraq, that he could have it. And look, practically it's happening. It's happening all under the table, as Cindy pointed out. All these sort of emergency authorities and the paying for it through emergency supplemental appropriations. It doesn't mean that we aren't actually doing these things. We're just doing them in the most expensive, most expedient, but most politically acceptable way.
Tom Donnelly, thanks very much indeed. Thanks to both my guests. Tom Donnelly is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Here in the studio with me, Dr. Cindy Williams, editor of the recently published Filling the Ranks, Transforming the U.S. Military Personnel System. Earlier we spoke to Stan Flora. He's a retired Army colonel. Andrew Exum, also retired from the Army and author of a new member, This Man's Army. And you heard Pam Hess, Pentagon's correspondent for UPI. You can continue the conversation in our online forums at www.theconnection.org. The Connection is produced by Anne-Marie Dorning, Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugarts. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR.